This is an ABC podcast.
2.5 years ago, in February of 2020, it started to rain. The rain brought to an end the Black Summer bushfires, which burnt through millions of hectares. Today, we know the cost of fixing up that landscape. Hello, I'm Richard Aidy. This is The Money, and this time we're focusing on the environment. The Albanese government has begun the process of working out how much the big greenhouse gas emitters will have to cut back. Remember, Labor went to the election promising to cut our greenhouse emissions 43% on 2005 levels by 2030. The document it has just put out starts to get that going. It's about reforming what's called the safeguard mechanism, a limit to how much the biggest emitters can emit. Hugh Grossman is Managing Director at Reputex, which analyses carbon markets. Hugh, how important is this?
I think if you view it under our emissions reduction target, this would really be the centrepiece policy. The safeguard mechanism would be targeting just under a third of Australia's emissions, about 28% actually, which would be primarily from the industrials segment. So if you're targeting that larger slice of emissions, which has previously been unregulated, it's a fairly big deal.
This is for consultation, isn't it? So the government's saying, here is what we think. Before we write the legislation, what do you reckon?
Correct, yeah. So the window now would be for initial consultation through September, and then from there the government will pull some thoughts together and come back with a draft of its preferred approach. But yeah, the expectation at the moment would be to have this legislated by the end of March next year, and then the new regime would commence from the 1st of July 2023.
All right. Now, you've mentioned the safeguard mechanism a couple of times. Can you explain what it is and who it applies to?
So the safeguard mechanism really sets an emissions limit, it's called an emissions baseline, on around about 215 of Australia's largest emitting facilities. Under the previous or the current safeguard mechanism, those facilities do have baselines, but those baselines are set very high. Essentially, they're set above where most companies currently report their emissions, which creates what we refer to as headroom. A lot of those facilities can increase their emissions and not get caught by their inflated baselines. So really, the objective of the new enhanced safeguard mechanism is to, you know, step back and say, right, how do we design this mechanism to actually work? How do we get rid of the headroom? And then how do we align those emissions baselines with net zero emissions by 2050? And obviously, in doing so, support Australia's 2030 target and, of course, future targets over time.
Just to be clear on the baseline, the scheme has been so generous that our emissions have gone up since its introduction. So it hasn't curtailed anybody so far. What are the numbers where we think we're looking at for the cuts?
I mean, look, it remains to be seen. You know, the government has a few different options in terms of how it can set emissions baselines. You know, for example, we could set industry average baselines where the average declines, or each facility could have its own trajectory down to net zero. So, you know, the rate of decline would really depend on what approach the government takes. With our modelling, you know, for the government back in December of last year, we assumed that each facility would have its own emissions reduction trajectory to net zero, and that would equate to around about a 3.5% reduction in emissions year on year. So obviously, as we go through the years, that becomes steeper over time and ultimately gets to zero by 2050.
Yeah. Hugh, what about the so-called EITE industries, which of course are primarily but not all manufacturers with very significant emissions that face overseas competition? What's going to happen with them?
It's always interesting to hear how industry responds, and more importantly, how the media responds to the treatment of these trade-exposed industries. This debate began back in 2010, you know, when Australia first had its carbon price on the table. You know, at that point in time, we didn't want to unfairly disadvantage Australian entities. When we flash forward, you know, over a decade from where we first started, the idea of competitive risk has changed because We have the Paris Agreement in place now. Most countries internationally have their own emissions reduction targets to reduce their emissions. And so the companies that are operating in those countries also have their own emissions reduction targets. So the idea of being disadvantaged is very different to what it was a decade ago. The second thing is that around about 60% or even 70% of companies that are covered by the safeguard mechanism have voluntarily adopted a net zero target. So this time around, we've got industry leading the charge, wanting to be regulated. So, you know, while we do need to be conscious of policy creating a competitive distortion, the world has turned where I don't think that that risk is as big as it was maybe a decade ago.
In the paper, I saw something about tailored treatment options to ensure that they're not disadvantaged. And that could be subsidies to help shift to low emissions technologies.
Yeah. And I think getting the balance right between requiring those companies to reduce emissions and sort of not exempting them from reducing emissions versus making sure that the cost of that action is not so high that it creates a competitive distortion is really the big challenge here. From our perspective, the way that you do that is not by withdrawing those guys from the market or, for example, saying, look, everyone else is going at 3.5% per annum. Why don't you guys go at 1%? You know, all that does is just pass the buck to someone else and requires a non-trade exposed facility. Domestic airlines, for example, they would be required to do all the heavy lifting. So that's not a very good approach. But what we would propose is that you can contain costs. You can reduce costs that are incurred on the back end. And that would be through a tax rebate, for example, or one of the proposals in the discussion paper is priority access to funding from the government to help these companies actually reduce emissions. So I think there are many ways that you can cut it, but ultimately those solutions these days are not really exemptions, which I think is at the heart of the, you know, the principle.
Hugh Grossman from Reputex. This is The Money with me, Richard Adey. The Black Summer bushfires were the biggest in living memory. They directly caused 33 deaths and almost 450 more from smoke inhalation. We lost 3,000 homes and it's estimated 3 billion animals. And it's that natural realm we're going to look at now because research led by WWF and the University of Queensland has worked out how much it would cost to repair the environmental damage. Michelle Ward has the numbers.
So our research found that it would cost about $16 billion a year to recover 65% of fire-impacted species habitats. If we wanted to bump that up to 95%, it would cost about $73 billion a year.
How long is that for, Michelle?
It's for 30 years, so we calculated costs over a 30-year period, after which we assume that trees planted should be fully established, logging of native forests should be transitioned into plantations. There will be some ongoing costs after that 30 years, like weed control, but we believe that with better technology, we envision that cost will come down dramatically. So that's why we halted at a 30-year period.
Those are still, of course, very significant sums. How do you arrive at those figures?
We produced spatially variable cost models in which we accounted for four different variables. So labour, consumables, equipment, and travel. So labour, that component was a summation of personnel hours required to complete the action. Consumables was all about, you know, how much you actually need to send people out there and cover their accommodation and food, petrol for burning, if that was the action, or herbicide for getting rid of the weeds. The equipment is all about the equipment that was needed to actually do the action. So, for example, herbicide sprayers or shovels or the actual plants to replant, and then travel.
What would the work of getting this to happen actually involve?
It's a range of different things that cause degradation. So it's not just about replanting trees. In most cases, when you remove a threat like invasive herbivores, naturally the sites will repair. So it's things like replanting, but it's also things like invasive herbivore removal, things like rabbits, deer, pigs. It's paying farmers their opportunity costs to not use land for farming and actually let it restore to natural habitats. It's also things like weed management and ecological fire management.
Actually, these are short sentences, but big ambitions to control things like rabbits, deer, pigs, invasive predators. We have not been successful, for the most part, at doing that. This would be, in fact, a remaking of the landscape.
Absolutely. Yeah, we envision that these actions need to happen at a large scale to have the impact that we need. You have to remember that these sites have been degraded for such a long time and our efforts so far have been so minimal, so that the scale of the effort needs to be ramped up dramatically.
Why is there such a big difference between getting back two-thirds of what we've lost, which I think was $16 billion a year, and a much bigger portion, 95% of what we've lost?
So our prioritisation model chooses the areas that have the most species for the cheapest cost. So it's a cost-effective analysis. That's why, you know, the remaining 30% are all the really expensive places, but are all the extra little bits of habitat to make up that additional 30%. So that as the model runs, the areas that we grab become dramatically more expensive.
Right, so more remote or more rugged or both?
More remote, more rugged. Perhaps they also have lots of different threatening processes. So, for example, maybe they've got a combination of replanting, weed control, rabbit control, invasive herbivore control. All of these costs stack up into a really expensive area to manage. And if there's only one species there, then perhaps it's not a cost-effective area. So in that case, our model flips over to, you know, it targets those cost-effective areas first.
So there's something like 16 million hectares that you're looking at. I think that's more or less what was damaged in the fires. At $16 billion a year, I think that's $1,000 a hectare. At $73 billion, it's about $4,500. What would we get for it?
If we were able to restore these landscapes, we could see the recovery of these fire-impacted species, and not just the fire-impacted species, but lots of other co-occurring species there. So Australia has one of the worst extinction rates in the world. We've got the highest mammal extinction rate across the board. With this sort of restoration scale, we could recover these species in a way for now, but also for the future. So our research targets not only current habitats, but where we expect species to move in the future under climate change. So it's a climate-ready restoration game changer.
There's also, as I understand, the possibility of using some of this for carbon sequestration. How much are we talking about?
Yeah, so with all the restoration, we also figured out that carbon could be sequestered, and we also figured out how much that would be worth on a carbon market. So in terms of carbon, it's about 291 megatons, and using a $26 ton carbon price, that translates to about $253 million a year.
Right, so that's a significant amount of money, but it's a very small portion of what this would cost to do. Mm-hmm. It's an economic contribution rather than an economic argument, if I could put it that way.
Yeah, that's right. And so we envision that, you know, we could get some of it from the carbon market, but it really does need to be a coordinated effort to make up that difference from government to private sector to NGOs. It's also really important to remember that that a healthy environment delivers much more than just money. It provides oxygen, clean water, it can prevent disease, it can shield us from big catastrophic climate events. But unfortunately, these costs are not calculated in the destruction of our natural places.
No, indeed. Just to put it in perspective, how much have we already committed to spending to try to repair the damage of the Black Summer fires?
So the government committed about $200 million. $50 million of that was spent in the first 12 months after the bushfires, and then an additional $150 million for the 2 years after.
That's just nothing like enough, is it? If you look at the maths you've done, $200 million, a one-off sum, it's not going to get us anywhere, really.
No, it's a drop in the ocean. But I guess with the incoming government, the new Labor government, we're expecting a lot more funds to be channeled towards things like threatened species recovery and restoring our natural legacy.
What about the risk that we spend this money and we get this work done, and then in our warming climate, I think you know where I'm going, Michelle, we see more bushfires rip through it, undoing all that work and releasing all that carbon?
Yeah, so Australia has had 200 years worth of degradation since European colonisation, and most of the sites that were burned were actually degraded. Plus, we continue to log our native forests. All of this degradation actually leads itself to more fire risks. So we think that if we can restore these landscapes in a really smart, climate-adapted way, we can prevent these big, big catastrophic disasters from happening in the future.
Yeah, and a reminder that some things are bigger than the economy, and we'll say that even here on The Money. Michelle, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Michelle Ward is a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Queensland and a conservation scientist at WWF. Many people have been enormously encouraged by the business sector's seeming willingness to engage with climate change. Indeed, in some countries, including this one, business has been ahead of government. But what has so-called green capitalism achieved when it comes to reducing carbon emissions? Adrienne Buller says not that much. In her book, The Value of a Whale, she says that if we want to limit climate change, we have to stop thinking that economics will achieve that.
What's becoming increasingly a problem for responding to the climate crisis is the fact that we tend to have this kind of puritanically economic lens through which we have to evaluate kind of every environmental and climate decision that we make. So, you know, we can only appraise everything in terms of sort of dollars and cents. And that, I think, has been sort of fundamentally limiting in the way that we respond to climate change. And again, the kind of perspective of economics as a profession has really influenced the types of climate policies that we are pursuing or that we even think are reasonable. And as the book argues, I think that's often not for the better.
So it's really about how we frame things and where we begin from. This brings us to the kind of the meat of the book, which is the rise of green capitalism. Can we start with the definition? What is green capitalism?
I define green capitalism in the book in a particular way based on just kind of few years of observing, I guess, what I saw as policy trends. And it just seemed like an emerging framework for responding to the climate crisis, which is, you know, an unprecedented crisis for profitability, for financial returns. And so it is genuinely a threat to capitalism and the interests at the top of the kind of hierarchy in capitalism. And so the response to it, I sort of saw two major trends. And one is kind of how can we respond to this crisis and this threat in a way that does as little as possible to disrupt kind of existing systems and distributions of wealth and power and existing institutions. Because if you are sort of a capitalist power, a powerful corporation or business or, you know, policymaker who benefits from the system, obviously it makes sense to you to try and resolve this in a way that does very little to change the kind of underlying systems in which we live. And then the second was to, again, respond to this in a way that creates sort of new opportunities and areas for private actors to profit.
Yeah, well, we will unpack this a bit. But if you start from first principles, market economics and saving the planet aren't a particularly natural fit.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, markets do some things well. And as the book argues, this is just, it's simply just not one of them. You know, markets are inherently based around the price signal or prices as kind of the ultimate arbiter of information. And it's, you know, exchanging information between rational actors. And this really kind of falls apart for either the climate or ecologically. So if you think about the climate question and just carbon emissions, you know, even if we were to put a price on carbon globally, there are huge problems about pacing because you can't simply say, okay, this is now more expensive and I'll just move to a lower carbon alternative, because often those don't exist, or we have systems that are fossil fuel systems that are hugely embedded and that require a much more sort of planned systemic response to avoid, you know, what could potentially be a lot of pain and a lot of harm for people in that transition. And the same goes for the ecological question, if not even more so, which is, you know, trying to arrive at a price for different aspects of the ecosystem means that we kind of have to disaggregate an inherent kind of like interconnected whole into constituent parts, which, yes, just falls apart ecologically very, very quickly.
Well, this gets us, I think, to the title of your book, The Value of a Whale. And you'd walk through this in some length, but let's walk through it very quickly. What did they come up with?
Yeah, so the value of a whale comes from a sort of small research paper published by the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, And they basically said, you know, whales are probably good to conserve, and it comes from a good place then, I suppose. And so to do that, we need to put a price on them. And they decided they were worth 2 million each, or about a trillion for the global stock of great whales, based on ecotourism and their role in sequestering carbon, which is something they do quite well.
Right. Yes. You can see how problematic it is. All right. So market failure was acknowledged by the British economist Nicholas Stern in the 2006 Stern Review on the Economics of Climate Change. What role has that report played in this idea of market solutions to climate change?
It's hard to kind of overstate the influence it's had, and Nicholas Stern is a hugely influential figure in the climate space. And it's basically done exactly what we just talked about with the whale, which is say that the climate crisis or environmental harm is a failure of the market because it's not priced. So because we don't reflect the cost of carbon emissions or the cost of biodiversity loss appropriately in the market, it fails to kind of address those appropriately. And so the way to resolve that is to what's called internalize those externalities, if we're going to use terms, into the market, which basically means, you know, put a price on carbon, put a price on a whale, or put a price on environmental damage, so that market actors will respond to that higher cost in ways that kind of avoid those damages. And that framework is basically, you know, the overarching mindset that guides, you know, most climate policy within governments, whether that's, you know, Australia, Canada, the UK, the US, all across Europe. And this is kind of the guiding logic that we follow. And most kind of policies are designed around this idea of pricing it into the market.
And I'll come back to that, but just while we're here, carbon pricing and an emissions trading scheme, we've had many political fights about them in Australia, but you question whether pricing carbon, which is the central tenet that you've just unpacked for us, actually makes any difference at all.
You know, when we talk about pricing carbon, for me, one of the biggest concerns I have is exactly what you've just talked about, which is all over the world, governments have spent, you know, decades just trying to even get very basic carbon pricing and carbon trading regimes in place as what's supposed to be kind of like the golden goose of policy. And that's been a huge distraction in many ways. And then you kind of have to arrive at the question of whether they even work. So sort of meta-analyses of existing sort of results that we have from carbon pricing regimes suggest that actually their impact is really limited. It's between, you know, 0 and 2% per year on average. Even the EU emissions trading scheme, which is sort of like the crown jewel of EU climate policy, when you look at their overall territorial emissions, is 0.5% to 1.5% per year over the 15 years it's been operational. And that's a scheme that's had an unbelievable amount of political attention and energy paid to it. And, you know, a lot of this comes down to fundamental questions about, you know, disagreements over what a carbon price should be, as well as, you know, a lot of lobbying to weaken the scale of the price, you know, the industries included. So I guess the idea of the carbon price is it's meant to kind of like escape the messy politics of climate change by just punting it over to the market and saying, you know, we'll just leave it to those market actors. But it actually, you know, has, as Australia definitely understands, has definitely not escaped the messiness of politics. And so we're dedicating all this attention to a process that ultimately ends up not really working, because to be functional from a carbon cutting kind of perspective, carbon prices would have to just be, you know, far, far higher than they currently are in a way that could be quite debilitating for a lot of people, particularly at like the lower end of the income spectrum.
Yeah. You dedicate some time to the sustainable finance industry, an industry that is growing very much, actually. If we leave aside firms that are shonky and are just not doing what they say they're doing, what is the problem there?
For me, there's a kind of more fundamental set of problems to the approach, one of which is that it's an approach based on financial risk. So the risk of the climate crisis to your financial portfolio, rather than the risks that your portfolio is creating by contributing to the climate crisis or, you know, failing to help contribute to a greener future. So it ends up being kind of actually disinterested in the question of, you know, what are we doing relative to the climate, as opposed to how can I just minimize the extent to which my returns are exposed to climate change. So you end up with, even in funds that aren't sort of greenwashing insofar as having, you know, coal companies in a climate fund, most ESG funds, for example, tend to just be filled with kind of big tech and pharmaceutical companies and all the kind of major corporations you'd see in any kind of bog standard fund. And the second problem with it is that, you know, sustainable finance and the kind of big numbers that tend to get thrown around about, you know, here's several trillions of dollars are now invested sustainably in all these things. It creates this kind of veneer that there's all this action happening and there's all this cash being funneled to these things when actually there is very little. And I worry a lot that that creates sort of an excuse for government and policy inaction.
Now, I'm going to sound like an economist, which I'm not, but what then are the measures for solutions? What would work?
Yeah, so I guess in the book, I kind of leave particular policy solutions a bit open-ended. But I think what I try and do is provide, yeah, criteria, as you say, for what we should be looking at. And I think the very first thing, this sounds a bit silly because it's so obvious, is does it actually work? Does the solution we're proposing actually sort of cut carbon or help us conserve biodiversity on anything like the kind of scale and pace required? Very basic hurdle to jump. Great. And then the second set of hurdles that I think are important, not just from the perspective of, you know, our values, but also from a purely pragmatic perspective, is, you know, does this create a future that isn't just kind of habitable, but also one that's, you know, worth living in and in which, you know, most people can live a better life, can have a more secure basic standard of living? And finally, does it sort of address questions around inequality and injustice? And again, that isn't just something that I consider a nice to have because I care about justice and inequality. Even beyond that, from the perspective of the climate and environment, you know, these are fundamentally crises that are based in enormous inequality. And it's not something that we'll be able to address without, you know, coming to terms with that sort of uncomfortable reality.
I am concerned that if you're right, the way to tackle climate change is consuming less and consuming it more equitably, sharing it better, which takes away the great motivator of the profit motive. And what it leaves is hard decisions for governments to make and hard decisions for them to sell to their electors.
Yeah, the political question is really challenging. But I think what I always point back to is even when we have something that is, you know, carbon pricing is a great example. That's something that technically is, you know, allows the profit motive to remain and to allow this to be sort of left up to the market. And it still doesn't escape the political struggle. It's still been kind of embroiled in partisan debate. And so I think, you know, we should accept that the messiness of politics is going to be part of this, but also in sort of selling this, as it were. Yes, there are some parts of our society that I think are, you know, and some things that we produce and some things we consume that are hugely wasteful from a climate and ecological standpoint, but that also don't really contribute to sort of human well-being and thriving. And so I think, you know, the idea that we need to in aggregate consume and waste less, it definitely evokes this sense of like austerity or lack. But in reality, I think it really could be the opposite, which is that, you know, we have an economy that barely serves huge amounts of people. You know, in the UK where I live, there are millions of people who this winter will be unable to pay their bills because we have a gas price crisis that is just driving them through the roof. So if we have an economy that's already failing so many people, you know, this is an opportunity to reconsider the way that we organize that, you know, what we produce, how we consume, to actually sort of build an economy that is not nearly as wasteful and that serves everyone much more rather than just kind of an increasingly small and select few.
I think that is where we'll leave it. It is a sobering but really interesting read. Thank you very much, Adrian, for joining us today on The Money.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Adrian Buller's Director of Research at Commonwealth, a think tank in the UK, and her books, The Value of a Whale. The Money is produced by Kate McDonald. I'm Richard Addy.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.